Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writers series. We're picking up with our reading of St. John Cassian's conferences, and we're finally reading the final conference of the text, Conference 24, the second with Abraham on mortification, and this will bring us to the conclusion of the text, and then we'll be moving on to Isaac the Syrian, hopefully here within another month, maybe with the beginning of the new school year. So it's another wonderful conference, I think a good way for us to conclude, and it might not seem to be as applicable to us when we read through it. The title of it is on mortification, but we find Germanus and Cassian talking about their desire to move back closer to family members, to relatives, for a number of reasons, that either that they would help to convert them in some way, or that they would be taken care of, that their relatives would be able to provide for their food so that they could be more dedicated to prayer and study. And so they present this thought to Abba Abraham, and who seems a little bit exasperated with them in the beginning about it, that they somehow feel that they could go back and engage, even though some of the Egyptian monks would do this or would have the ability to do that, their families would be close enough that they could come out and visit them, that even they were very strict about this, though, and that somehow, though, Cassian and Germanus feel that they would be able to do this, to engage freely without there being a loss to the life of simplicity and, in particular, solitude. That not just the distractions, perhaps, that would go along with that, but there would be more subtle spiritual losses to be, for example, caught up in the daily affairs of others, to be subtly distracted from that pursuit of solitude. Now, for us, you know, we certainly haven't embraced the life of the desert, and so the way that we would read this would be a little bit different. But I think, nonetheless, it still speaks to us that if we are fostering a kind of simplicity in our spiritual life, where we are seeking to develop a deeper prayer life, that we want a kind of solitude to emerge there in order that we could draw closer to God in prayer, that we do have to be cautious about our involvement in the things of the world and doing that in without discrimination. That all the things that we could become involved in, family affairs, we could get involved in, you know, disputes within families, and to such an extent that we become more and more burdened down by that reality. That it's not saying that we wouldn't act in charity towards others, care for those who are sick, but sometimes we can get caught up in family disputes or things such as that, and so become distracted from our deeper purpose in life. And as Christians, we're all called to that fundamental holiness of those who've been baptized, and so we want to pursue that as fully as we can too. And sometimes we can feel pressured in our family relations to participate in things that might make it very difficult for us to pursue fully the life of prayer and other ascetical practices that we need in order to overcome the passions. If you're engaged in a life of prayer, you know, often those who might not be engaged in it very deeply or participating in their faith will find it a little bit of an inconvenience. Oh, you know, what are you doing? You have to pray again. We have these plans. We're going out to do certain things. And so there can be this temptation to break off of those disciplines. And so we want to be careful and mindful of that. And so hopefully we'll be able to glean some of the wisdom here of Abba Abraham that he offers to Germanus and Cassian. So we're picking up this evening on page 819 with the translator's introduction. The final conference brings to the mystical number of 24, the conferences in Cassian's work. And a neat connection is drawn between the 24 elders of the Book of Revelation and those whose discourses Cassian has recorded, even though Cassian's elders only add up to 15. The last of these is Abba Abraham, who may be identical with one of the two of that name in the Apothegmata Patrum, the first of whom has a section allotted to him, while the second appears as a disciple of Abba Sissos. It is perhaps not coincidental that this Abraham, whoever he may be, has the same name as does that Old Testament patriarch, who was commanded by God in Genesis 12:1, "Leave your country, your family, and your father's house, for the land I will show you," inasmuch as part of his task will be to inculcate in his two charges the spirit that motivated that Abraham. The discussion begins when the two friends tell the old man that they are moved to return to their homeland in order to be cared for by their relatives, and they express the hope that their presence might even help to affect their relatives' conversion. After a long silence and a deep groan, Abraham sets out with dispatch to lay bare the all-too-obvious self-deception implicit in this plan. He accuses Cassian and Germanus of slothfulness and tells them that the Egyptian monks would long since have taken advantage of their relative support and other things that the world might have offered them had they not been dissuaded by the gospel. Instead, they chose to live in the harshest desert and once there to remain in their cells, concentrating on God and seeking to avoid the distractions. So even though the Egyptian relatives would have been closer and had the capacity to come out and visit them, that the Egyptian monks would have been nonetheless guarded in that visitation or avoided it altogether, knowing that it could be used to pull them away from the life that they had chosen. So monks are to be stayers at home, much like Oratorians, I shall remind you. One of the students posted on Facebook this week a picture of a street somewhere in the United States called David Abernathy Street, and with saying proof that Father David goes outside. Fortunately, the last name was spelled incorrectly, so it was easy to disprove their slanderous thoughts, but however, I digress. So back to the translator's introduction. As this Germanus rejoins that while remaining in one's cell is certainly a good rule to follow, it is unclear why one should keep a distance from one's relatives, particularly inasmuch as some Egyptian monks do not, without thereby hindering their advance toward perfection. Abraham answers by observing that different practices are useful for different persons, and that Egyptian customs might not carry over well into another context. Many Egyptian monks have the inner strength to live very near their relatives without being in the least troubled by them, and he cites the striking example of Abba Apollos. Cassian and Germanus, the old man implies, might not have the strength of character to resist their relatives' enervating attentions. I thought that was sort of an interesting little take on things, enervating attentions, that there would be something that would be agitating about that relationship that could exist, that they would be drawn back into the pace of the world or to be thinking about the things of the world in such a way as to disturb the inner peace that they had worked so hard to foster. Germanus admits that their relatives would never permit them to practice certain austerities, but would it not be desirable for their families to look after their food so that they themselves could read and pray without interruption? Here Abraham adduces the words of Anthony to the effect that a life of toil is imposed upon a monk by scriptural precept. The demand that prayer not be separated from work, which is the burden of the 11th and 12th chapters, is a constant in monastic literature. Almost certainly the Messalinian movement, which discarded work in favor of constant prayer, is being aimed at here by Cassian. Then, returning to the possibility raised by the two friends that they might be able to convert their relatives, Abraham declares that a quiet life in the desert is far safer than the one in the world, however many converts one might gain. So there is a benefit, Abraham is telling them here, to living a kind of life of toil, that even though it might seem beneficial to have one's food provided and not have to be anxious about those things, that you can begin to not rely as much upon the providence of God, that having to toil in some way daily just for the food of the day is something important on a spiritual level. We'll see in greater detail here as he works through it what he means, but you begin to get the sense very clearly that there is a value to that, that the monks would not have wanted to embrace a kind of like building up a retirement nest egg kind of thing, that they would have wanted to embrace as much as they could the gospel, you know, precept of living today and trusting in what God would provide for them. And so not working harder and harder to store up food for themselves or to try to gain as much from their relatives or other benefactors in order to, you know, drive out that reliance upon the providence of God altogether. They can begin to rest upon themselves and their own goods rather than really resting upon the grace of God and trusting that he would provide for them, or being allowed to suffer something of the hardship of that and what that requires of a person spiritually, you know, to be in want or not to know what if one is going to have enough food for the morrow, that there is a kind of faith that produces and deepens. And for a monk who's embraced this particular life, that would be a great loss. And, you know, certainly living in the world, we have some other indifferent concerns, and those who are raising families certainly would have different concerns too. But we can see how easy it is to get up and get to that point where we are storing up, you know, more and more goods, more and more money in order to provide beyond what would be necessary for our sustenance and to provide for our homes, you know, that we can become overly fixated upon that. Okay. Aware of the error, Germanus now asked the old man where such an idea might have come from and how it can be dealt with. Abraham replies that all vice has a single source, although it shows itself in different ways, depending on what part of the soul it attacks, whether the reasonable, the irascible, or the concupiscible. In the case of Cassian and Germanus, it is the reasonable part that suffers from presumption and vainglory, and it must be cured by humble discretion. The weaker parts of one's soul, in any event, or those that are first subjected to demonic onslaughts. So, you know, it's part of it has to do with the bodily appetites and the passions that are associated with those. So that he's saying it doesn't have to do. Part of it is reasonable for them because it's presumption and vainglory. So I was wrong about that. So part of it is that, you know, that they feel that they can convert their relatives, you know, that there's a kind of vainglory in that, that, you know, that they should be closer to them. Germanus then voices a consideration that he has made the possibility of leaving the desert look more attractive, namely the fact that the occasional visits of the brothers interrupted the seclusion and fasting that they so desired. The reader will view the consideration in question with a certain skepticism and will wonder how the two friends would have prevented the visits of their relatives. But Abraham says that such visits are signs of the holiness of the persons being visited and that moreover the devil tempts those who live in the desert to long for more distant places, for utopias where one may supposedly pursue one's religious practices with much less hindrance. In fact, however, the visits of the brothers have a salutary effect on both body and spirit. They serve as a necessary relaxation and refreshment. So, you know, what Abraham is telling them is that, you know, for a solitary, for one who has embraced the life of an anchorite, the fantasy that he is going to have or she is going to have is that I could even have deeper prayer if I go farther and farther out into the desert. And so they create this little fantasy, utopia, that nobody, I won't be bothered by anybody, and I can just exist out there. And so the visits of these relatives sort of pull them back from that in some way, because it often will reveal to them still weaknesses within their character that mean that they need to live among others. And it also can help prevent them from falling into sort of extreme practices in their asceticism. By having it interrupted occasionally, it's going to humble them, but it also keeps them from being too extreme about it. That you begin to see the fasting as, you know, a long-term kind of part of your spiritual life, a constant. If it's interrupted because of need for hospitality, so be it. You're humbled, you have to let go of your own will in regards to the ascetic practice. Whereas somebody who has this fantasy of going further and further out in the desert could go out there and fast in very extreme ways and then hurt themselves. So for the Egyptian monks who embraced this life in the deep desert, you know, having that interrupted every once in a while is going to be a good thing. But it's not necessarily going to apply to these monks from the West, that the effect of that on them might be different. That these guys grew up in this kind of culture and desert sort of environment. So they were already hardened and toughened to be able to enter into that. It created a certain constitution that allowed them to enter into this, that for these Western guys wouldn't necessarily have existed. Like, I might have some fantasy about going off to the deserts of Egypt, but I'd probably last about a day and then fall over dead. Now, where's the air conditioning? Find me a cave that's 70 degrees.
Cold water.
That's right. And that, yeah, bottled water. Okay. Where did I leave off? I'm sorry.
Satisfied?
Satisfied with this response, Germanus asked, apparently apropos of nothing in particular, for an explanation of Matthew 11:30, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So Germanus sort of engages in a little non sequitur here. And although I'm sure when we read through, maybe we'll be able to make a connection. The truth of these words of the Lord seemed to be belied by other scriptural passages that promise suffering to the serious Christian. The key to understanding the passage, Abraham replies, is humility. The person who is humble and who submits his will to others will no longer experience as oppressive what would otherwise be qualified as a yoke or a burden. It is obstinacy, rather, and the insistence on pursuing one's own will that make Christian life difficult and burdensome. The final chapter of the conference deals with the hundredfold spoken of in Matthew 19:29, which can be understood in terms of the advantages that fall to those in monastic life. These advantages are not only the bonds among brothers, which are 100 times more precious than those that exist among persons related by blood. But even the very number of the brothers, since they are that much more numerous than one's blood family. Thus the final moments of the conference return to the theme with which the discussion began. And here, at last, the reward for severing one's family ties is proposed. As far as the persecutions foretold in Mark 10:30 are concerned, these are the mortifications that the monks practice and the violence that they do to themselves. Abraham concludes his commentary on the hundredfold with the rather unexpected observation that it also refers to the honors that the rulers of this world shower on the monks. The conference ends with some self-deprecating words of Cassian that touch upon his ability to convey to others the fiery utterances of the Abbas whose teachings he has attempted to record. And the last sentence, which is the last sentence of the work as a whole, recalls the sea voyage imagery of the... I'm sorry, what is that?
Can you spell it? I have no idea.
What the reference is there, I'm having...
P-R-A-V-S.
If that's from the first conference, the voyage imagery of the first conference, I think paragraph, would that be paragraph 3 or section 3? The journey out upon the wide waters of speech so dangerous to the monk is finally over, and the safe harbor of silence lies near at hand. So, not the clearest introduction, I think, and we'll be confirmed here, I think, as we go through why it's valuable to read every single word, because I think there are some connections why Germanus brings up the quote about the yoke being easy and the burden light, and so I think we'll be able to unpack it a little bit more. Okay. So let's jump right into the text and start to do that. With this 24th conference of Abraham, forged with the help of Christ, the teachings and precepts of all the elders come to an end. Once it is concluded, thanks to your prayers, and the number of mystically corresponds to that of the 24 elders, who in the Holy Apocalypse are said to offer their crowns to the Lamb, we believe that we shall be relieved of the debts of all our promises. If these 24 elders of ours have received crowns of glory because of the worthiness of their teaching, they will henceforth offer them with bowed heads to the Lamb who was slain for the salvation of the world. For he himself, for the honor of his name, deigned to give them an excellent understanding, and us the words appropriate to such profundity. And the value of his gift must be referred to the author of all good things, by the very act that the more is remitted by him, more is owed to him. And so, in an anxious confession, we laid before Abraham the struggle of our thoughts, which prompt us with daily turmoil of soul to return to our province and to see our relatives again. A great desire was occasioned in us by the fact that we remembered the aforementioned relatives of ours with such devotion and love that we imagined that they would never hinder our chosen orientation. We constantly thought over in our mind that we would receive much more from their solicitude, and that we would be preoccupied by no worries about bodily things, and not be distracted by looking for food if they concerned themselves joyfully with providing for absolutely all our needs. Of course. That's all right. That sounds pretty wonderful
absolutely
to me too. Moreover, that's why so many people move home after college to live with their parents. Same kind of logic.
Absolutely.
They'll love it. I'll move home and they'll provide for all my needs. Moreover, we also fed our souls with the hope of foolish joys, believing that we would gain very great fruit out of the conversion of the many persons who would be, as it were, guided by the way of salvation by our example and admonitions. Certainly a humble thought. In addition, there was painted before our eyes the setting of the ancestral property of our forebears and the pleasant and delightful nature of that region, and how graciously and agreeably it stretched out to the reaches of the wilderness, so that the recesses of the forest might not only gladden a monk, but also provide sufficient supplies of food.
That's set up really nicely.
It is, yeah. No wonder he groans. When we disclosed all this, simply and in accordance with the faith of our conscience, to the aforesaid old man, and when we bore witness with abundant tears that we could no longer endure the force of the onslaught, unless by the grace of God he came to our aid with a remedy. He kept silent for a long while and finally said with a deep groan, "The weakness of your thoughts shows that you have not yet renounced your worldly desires or mortified your former yearnings. These errant desires of yours testify to the fecklessness of your heart. It is only the flesh that you have that you are enduring this pilgrimage, and this absence from your relatives, which you should rather be taking up in your mind. For all of this would have already been buried and completely removed from your hearts if you had seized upon the reason for this renunciation and the principal motive of the solitary life that is ours. Therefore, I think that you are laboring under the malady of slothfulness, which is spoken of as follows in Proverbs: every slothful person is full of desires. And again, desires kill the lazy." So he doesn't hold back. If we had a spiritual director who told us, you know, "You're pretty lazy, you're slothful," we'd probably run out of the room crying. "For we ourselves would not be lacking the supplies of carnal goods that you spoke about if we believed that they were appropriate to our chosen orientation, or if we judged that we could get as much fruit for ourselves from the delights of these pleasures as we obtain from the harshness of our location and from the brokenness of our body. Nor are we bereft of the comfort of our relatives that we would lack people who would rejoin to sustain us out of their own pockets if we were not confronted by the words of the Savior, which cut off whatever pertains to the nourishment of this flesh, and which say, 'Whoever does not abandon or hate father and mother and children and brothers cannot be my disciple.' But even if we were utterly bereft of our relatives' assistance, we would not lack the kind of offices of the powers of this world, who would gratefully rejoice to attend to our needs with the most prompt generosity. Supported by their munificence, we would not be worried about obtaining food if the prophetic curse did not act on us as a strong detriment. For it is said, 'Cursed is the man who places his hope in man,' and 'Do not trust in princes.' Likewise, if we had located ourselves at least on the banks of the river now, we would have had water at our doorsteps, and we would not have been obliged to carry it on our backs for 4,000 paces, except that the blessed apostle made us unwearying in putting up with this labor and constantly encouraged us with the words that he said, 'Everyone shall receive his reward in proportion to his labor.' Nor are we unaware that there are also several pleasant retreats in our area in which a supply of fruit and the delightful and abundant gardens would meet our need for food with a minimum of bodily labor, except that we fear the reproach which would be made against us and which was directed to the rich man in the gospel: 'You received your consolation in your life.' But we despised all these things and disdained them along with each one of the world's pleasures, and we delight only in this harshness, preferring the redoubtable vastness of this desert to every luxury. Nor can we compare the wealth of any field, however fertile, to the bleakness of this sand, for we are pursuing not the temporal profits of the body, but the eternal gains of the spirit. For it is a very small matter for a monk to have made a renunciation only once, that is, to have despised present things at the beginning of his conversion, if he does not continue to renounce them every day. Up until the end of his life, he must say with the prophet, 'You know that I have not desired the day of man.' Hence also the Lord says in the gospel, 'If anyone wants to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross every day, and follow me.'" So they've missed a pretty major part of the meaning of their pilgrimage to Egypt that they still haven't seen, even here as late as this 24th conference, what it means to make that renunciation and how important it is not to want to escape it once one has made it, that there is fulfilling of the gospel commands in that renunciation, but there is also spiritual benefit in the hardship that they would endure on a daily basis, the labor that they would endure, that they could have, even though they live in Egypt, they could have lived near the Nile, as he said, that water would have been abundant and they could have walked down and got what they needed instead of having to walk 4,000 paces. And they could have also made use of places where there were fruit, there was fruit in abundance and things like that, where they would have been able to eat what they needed and when they wanted. Instead, they actively and intentionally chose a path that was consistent with their calling, and that was not to, you know, to seek the things of this world, but to seek the things of the kingdom, and to seek also the spiritual benefits that the asceticism of living in that environment would provide them, that there was a natural hardship of the environment that would require this deep trust in the providence of God, and that would also humble the body and humble the mind in such a way that they would not want to relinquish. And so you see how far the Germanus and Cassian are. I mean, they're thinking about, they eventually go back to France. So, you know, they're thinking of like the woods and, you know, green areas and things like that, and how wonderful that would be as a peaceful place of solitude for monks to live. And for these Egyptian monks, it's like, you know, what you're saying is idiotic, you know, and certainly not consistent with what you've learned here over these past years, you know, that you would be losing something by that. You're not gaining anything by it. Again, I think that's hard for us to understand. That, especially in our day, I think we, you know, every like technological gain, you know, the thought is that everything is going to make things easier and that will give us more and more free time. I think we've talked about, or somebody brought this up once before, about the washing machine, that would free up more time in the home, in the work, because the clothes would be washed through this machine rather than to hand wash them and then hang them up. But it never proved to be true, you know, that, you know, more and more things came up or things filled that schedule in one way or another. And that's true, I think, with every technological gain that we see, like computers and things like that. It's not like, you know, they've made our lives so simple. It's not like the Star Trek utopia kind of thing, Earl Grey hot, please, you know, and then it produces it, and so we're able to have our tea materialize and then, you know, get right to our work. That for more often than not, it becomes a distraction for us. All those things require a certain level of attention and a certain level of work in order to obtain them as well. And he uses some examples here that follow in the following chapters about how we can be drawn into that, that we can work and we can see, okay, people are responding to our work in such a way, we're doing a good job, and so if I work a little harder and longer, I'll get more people who are interested in that work and labor, and so I'll be able to store up or more goods for myself, or at least begin to be able to taste something that the rich or the blessed of this world get to taste. And in the end, it all, they're saying, is one big distraction and ultimately leads to a kind of unhappiness, that more and greater goods doesn't necessarily bring you know, peace of mind and heart, simplicity. In fact, it can steal it from us and very, very easily.
So these are all the things that we can amass.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking too that another reason that Abraham is such a great name, at least to have us leading us out here, is because Abraham is going to be led into the land.
Right.
He's not going to get himself there.
Right.
So even in the vocation, you are not going to get yourself there.
That's a good point, and he does make reference to that in particular. It's like a pathlessness,
even,
that we can spend a lot of time and energy thinking about, you know, where we should go or where we want to go, rather than allowing ourselves to be led by God. And I think that's even the more subtle and more problematic thing, that we make our discernment of the will of God, our discernment, what our judgment is telling us, rather than really allowing ourselves to listen to God and allow Him to lead us where He wants to go. And that might be wandering, you know, where we don't know where in the heck He's leading us or why.
And maybe being a little cold.
Right.
Or maybe not having enough to eat.
Right. That's right. It's humbling to read it. Because this is one of those deeper insights that sort of unearths the things that we take for granted and really shines a light on it. You know, just if we think on any given day, all those things that we have and we cling to and see as necessary to get us through that day, but in reality they do become something that is between ourselves and God. They get in, and they destroy a kind of simplicity that would allow our day-to-day life to be this constant interaction with God. And so we're always approaching God through this filter often that we've constructed. And often that can distort our vision of God and keep us from really hearing what he wants from us or responding, you know, to the level of conversion that he desires from us as well. Because we construct this whole reality around us that we think is the will of God and that we have to maintain and keep going. And it might have absolutely nothing to do with Christ or the kingdom. I think I left off at number 3, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
On 8:27. Therefore, the person who keeps constant watch over the purity of the inner man must seek out places that do not draw his mind to the distraction of cultivating them because of their abundant fertility, and that do not make him leave the fixed and set location of his cell and force him to do work outside, thus scattering his thoughts at large, as it were, and by all sorts of things, utterly diverting the aim of his mind and that most delicate focus of his goal. These cannot be provided for or seen by anyone, however careful and watchful, who has not kept his body and mind constantly enclosed within the confines of four walls. Thus attentive and unmoving, like a clever fisherman looking out for his food with apostolic skill, he may catch the swarms of thoughts swimming about in the calmest depths of his heart. And like someone gazing intently into the depths from a jutting promontory, may with wise discretion judge which fish he should draw to himself with his saving hook, and which ones he should let go and reject because they are wicked and harmful. Promontory, it's sort of raised up piece of ground that gives you a sort of a view over
the
ocean. Right.
Or body of one.
So interesting here, you know, that the simplicity then does allow for this deeper and deeper attentiveness to what's going on within, especially to those thoughts and their origin. And where they're leading. Are they leading us really to God and to, you know, catching what is most valuable and that will sustain us spiritually, or are they leading us away from that reality? And it can be far more subtle, as we see, than we imagine.
I think that's where this stuff comes in, being useful for us mm-hmm. in these right. times, because this state of mind mm-hmm. And spirit is a matter of a very subtle self-awareness mm-hmm. and what things are, what draws you, what doesn't draw you, mm-hmm. what repels you,
right.
what doesn't repel you, mm-hmm. and having some sense of how you move through things, you know, right. the day is fraught with, you know, just things that could be believable or real,
right.
that may have absolutely nothing to do with your transformation,
right.
you know.
What if it is the thing that is repulsive, if that's where God is,
right.
and often that's where God is, you know, or that's where the greatest virtue is going to be fostered within the heart too. Can be in the repulsive or the difficult thing, but you know, often we will want to get away from that, thinking, okay, this couldn't possibly be what God wants for me because it's so ugly or confusing or frustrating. You know, leaves me feeling like I'm hanging by a thread. You know, that kind of stuff. Yes.
I also like that kind of. Recalls the intentionality that at the very beginning, the idea of taking every thought captive and to God had, you know, that there would be such an intentionality there that you would know that there was a lot of stuff that you should let lie in the deep, you know, and that's really just not worth it. But every thought you do have, as you choose it, you take it captive for yourself mm-hmm. and for God, and that's kind of, that's very cool.
I think what worries me is that there are so many things that are coming at us on a day-to-day basis. It's not even the struggle with our own thoughts, mm-hmm. but it's with the noise around us, that if our own minds produce between 4,000 and, what did we say, 50,000 thoughts a day, depending on the person, you know, if you add to that everything that's coming at us from the outside, it could really make our lives, you know, a jumble and confusing and, you know, pretty frustrating. I think there is a loss, you know, and in that there is this profound, I think, loss of identity. You know, people don't know who they are. They don't know where they're going. They don't know God because they can't hear God, and so people are, you know, gravitating to all these things, trying to cling, hold on to something that will provide them with a sense of who they are, to create, to
affirm them,
right, in some way. And you know, I think when we look upon that, I think our first reaction is like, oh my gosh, it's so weird or strange or confusing. Why would that be true? But I think it is because there's a void that people are experiencing. You can tell how profound the void is too by all the things that are going on in our culture that are sort of, you know, so, I don't know, I'm trying to choose a word here that isn't, I don't want to say bizarre, but, you know, just so out of the norm or just, you know, disturbing at times and, you know, even seems like self-harm, you know, more often than not, and it's not just for those who are out at the margins. You know, I think it's those within the Christian community, too. Yes.
Not to be like super dramatic, but you know, I think if you surround yourself in kind of a community that's supportive of virtue and, you know, with godly people, I think, you know, sometimes one of the amazing things that happens is because you're open to those, the thoughts of God can come in through there. But in sort of on the mirror side of that, it seems like if you're just kind of like open and exposed to not only your own, but like anyone thoughts, everyone's thoughts. Like, you would be not necessarily limiting what you're exposing yourself to human thoughts, that you're really exposing yourself to something much more dangerous and sinister, and that, like, sort of the crowd can become a vehicle, either for good or for bad thoughts.
There's something paradoxical about it, because we live in such isolation, and yet we are so inundated with the internal life of others. There's so much that people, like, throw out there in a very public kind of fashion. And yet, despite that, it certainly hasn't brought, you know, deeper understanding or a kind of community, because it's not often not connected to anything. And so I think it can be really a kind of disturbing environment to live in. I mean, if you don't watch television and then you put television on for a little bit, the commercials, you know, it tells you, okay, they think we're morons. You know, it's really bizarre. And, you know, the kinds of television programs and things like that, too. It's just like, you know, if this is a reflection of our culture and how we are viewed, and this is, they're studying that, obviously, in order that they can sell things. It's really saying that, okay, they think we're idiots and, you know, that we're going to laugh at that and that we should make ourselves idiots too, and let's all just be idiots, and we'll be happy. Okay, where was I? Okay, let's see, number four here. If someone perseveres continually in this watchfulness, therefore, he will effectively bring to pass what is quite plainly expressed by the prophet Habakkuk. I will stand on my watch and go up upon a rock, and I will look out to see what he will say in me and what I should reply to him who reproaches me. The laboriousness and difficulty of this is very clearly proved by the experiences of those who dwell in the desert of Calamus and Porphyrion. They are cut off, it is true, from all cities and human habitation by a longer stretch of wilderness than is the desert of Skeet, since those who penetrate the vast and deserted wilderness barely arrive at their remote cells after 7 or 8 stops. Yet because they have dedicated themselves to gardening there and are not bound to their cells, when they come to the harsh places where we live or to Skeet, they are troubled with such tumultuous thoughts and with such anxiety of mind that, like beginners and those who have never even slightly acquired the discipline of the desert, they cannot bear the staying in their cells and the stillness of silence, and they are at once driven from there and made to leave as if they were tyros and novices, for they have not learned how to calm the movements of the inner man and to resist the storms of their thoughts by a constant concern and a persevering attentiveness, since they are working outdoors every day and are running about in the airy void, not only in the flesh, but even in the mind, scattering their thoughts everywhere in the open with their bodily activity. Therefore, they neither experience the capricious vanity of their soul, nor can they control its unstable wanderings. Not putting up with the contrition of spirit, they consider their own constant silence unbearable. Unwearying in their burdensome rural labors, they are overcome by calm and are worn out by their own lengthy stillness. It's curious. So even in this monastic life, what from all appearances would probably look very good or normal, that here you have a group of monks who've they've gone out really far, that it takes 7 or 8 stops to get to where they exist, but they've created this place where they can farm and be attentive to that, produce their own food. And in the process, they become absorbed with that, with the labor itself, and so aren't attentive to cultivating the soil within and being attentive to the thoughts. And so when they are pulled out of that environment where they're kept busy constantly, when they're pulled out of that environment and thrust into the desert of Skeet, where they have to stay within a cell, then they begin to discover, okay, not all is well within the human heart, that even what they've been doing is benign, that it's been a distraction from the interior battle and what they are meant to be cultivating in the silence of the desert, which is that stillness of mind, purity of heart, this ability to listen to God. So it's a very powerful example. Because again, it rips the carpet out from underneath us when we sort of say, well, okay, this is a good work, or there's obviously nothing wrong with this, you know, and that they would have said the same thing. And so, you know, how do we think about this in our own lives? You know, that we could, in our lives, be good people, you know, producing good things for the community, you know, very busy, active on all these different committees, city council or whatever it might be, or the community, whatever it might be, and yet be lacking, you know, the kind of formation that we need within the home, our families, that would foster this deep love for Christ and a deep love for the kingdom. You know, that there can still be something very worldly about the pursuit of a good life. You know, we weren't saved and redeemed by the blood of Christ to live a good life, you know, so that at our, you know, in our eulogy, they could say he was a good man, everybody liked him, you know, he, you know, was active in the community and, you know, generous with his time. You know, that's not a Christian, that's not the eulogy of a saint, that's the eulogy of a good man, you know, or a good woman. But, you know, are we called to something more, which is this radical abandonment to God and his will in our lives? And that might not be to experience even the good fruit of good actions. It might be to experience the cross and failure and suffering, illness, persecution, loneliness, isolation, you know, and to bear those in faith, to participate in the cross, to take up a cross daily and follow him. It's a lot to think about, I know. And if it should create some, you know, a little bit of consternation there, I think, for us to, you know, sort of wonder about that. Okay, is that true? You know, what are they saying here? Because we are taught that from very early on. You know, sort of like a kind of natural virtue, and then a kind of Christian veneer can be put over it, you know, over top of it, and, you know, but there is something about the gospel that's to be revolutionary, that is to shake things up. You know, don't think that I've come to bring peace, I've come to bring division or the sword. You know, that there is something that is to radically overturn our lives in the way that we see our life in this world.
So it's a midrash, doesn't really, goes back ways, that says something like that most craftsmen look for a tool to be in good working order, mm-hmm. but God can only use a tool after it's been broken. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not, you know, it doesn't preach at all, you know, to,
right.
to be able to say, you know, this is what we're going forward into.
Right.
You know, your brokenness might be just what God needs.
That's right. In a way that we can't the eyes of faith would see it. And I think where we see like the victim souls or those who suffer, those who know great illness, those who seem worthless in the eyes of the world, they're not producing anything, you know, valuable to the culture. And yet one wonders, you know, what does that, the depth of the faith there and the clinging to God in the midst of the isolation that that often brings, or the deep pain, and, you know, in terms of the conversion of the world, or the healing of the world.
I think that's really, really challenging, because it's saying something like people are only seen as saints in the hindsight of others, and sometimes hindsight of like hundreds of years. Not everyone's canonized like John Paul II, you know, like immediately, and because, you know, with popular demand and desire. Like, it takes hundreds of years. The people who lived with them thought they were nothing, would never have understood what the big deal about was. Maybe they were hated and disliked, and it's so appealing to think like, well, maybe even my whole life will be painful and suffering, but at my funeral, everyone will, you know, say like, okay, well, they seem like they did a good job. Like, that may not be the case
or
at
just
all.
Just never be.
Never be, no. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the reality. There's so many people who of deep faith who are just invisible in the eyes of the world, and yet are these incredible saints. You know, they cling to God in the midst of their suffering, but they're not the ones who are powerful or strong within or without the church. You know, it's, you know, they seem, they're utterly poor in spirit and in every way. Yes.
So it would seem that in the conundrum of the good man or the good woman, and as in the culture and the society that we live in, we can choose to do all sorts of good things if we like, and we can build up this nice life, right, of contributing. Those are our choices. That's our construct, right? And they might have some intrinsic value, but that's not our vocation per se, necessarily.
Yeah.
God might be calling us to something entirely different, and that's that radical call, whatever that is.
Right.
That's what our vocation
is. Right. And it might be the thing that is more repulsive to us because it goes against our will or our sensibilities, but would require the deeper love or the deeper faith, abandonment to God's providence.
Somewhere on the margin.
It is. That's right. It's a hard thing, you know, because it might be. You know, you can have a lot of things that you're engaged in. Sort of the thing as you were talking, the idea that came to mind was the rich man and Lazarus, that we typically, I think, demonize that rich man, you know, but he might have been a good guy, and he might have even contributed to charities, or, you know, you don't have a sense of, we don't know enough there, but he could have been, you know, on some levels an upright kind of individual, but he was blind to this repulsive figure that was at his gate, you know, for what reason we don't know, that he didn't want to enter into that, that there didn't seem to be any value in that, even spiritually, you know, like, you know, maybe, you know, what could I do for this person, you know, he certainly didn't want to enter into that reality with him. And I think, you know, in the church, it's easier for us to serve in very, like, controlled ways. You know, the programs, you know, projects, fundraisers, those kind of things. It's much more difficult, I think, for us to engage somebody that we meet who initially jars our sensibilities and is repulsive to us, or seems psychologically, you know, wounded, and to spend the time and the energy and attention in a genuine way on that person, even though it's not going to, you know, they're not going to give you any money. Not going to be any acknowledgement. They might not get it better. You might not be able to do anything for them other than love them and being engaged with them, you know.
Where
they aren't isolated, huh?
Why do we find that not to be enough just to love somebody? We want our love to somehow make a difference, right? And to change them and solve things. And I'm sorry for bursting out.
No, I think it's our pride. You know, that we want it, you know, we want to have this sense that we are doing something of value. Or even having, you know, a person owe us something, or the sense of, you know, accomplishment, even though it's a spiritual kind of thing.
Maybe we hope they'll get better so we can stop loving them. Because now they don't need to be loved anymore.
Right. It's much more difficult to love somebody in a sustained way over time when there's no obvious value for doing so. Or there's, you know, there's only them. There's the person, and that you are loving Christ in them. And it might be the broken Christ in them, you know, the one who's wounded, you know, the scourged one. So. Okay, where was I? Number five, right? There is nothing surprising in the fact that someone staying in a cell whose thoughts are gathered together as if in a very narrow closet should be suffocated with a multitude of preoccupations which burst out of the confines of the dwelling along with a person and which run about everywhere like unbridled horses. When they get free of their stables for a while, so to speak, there is at once a kind of brief and sad solace. But when the body returns to its cell, the whole troop of thoughts goes back as if to its own home, and the very habit of ingrained license excites more serious urges. When those then who cannot yet or do not yet know how to resist the onslaughts of their desires are troubled in their cells by the attacks of acedia in their hearts more violent than usual, and if by relaxing the strictness of the law they concede themselves the freedom of going out often, they will bring a worse plague upon themselves by this remedy, as they think it is. It is the same with certain people who believe that they can quell the force of internal fevers with a drink of very cold water, when in fact it is clear that this stirs up the fire rather than settling it, since a far graver sickness follows the momentary relief. So, you know, this is taking us a little off of what we were just talking about, but he's beginning to talk here about the kind of spiritual boredom, you know, of not wanting to remain in this state and engaged in that struggle. And so when we think about maybe what we were just talking about a few moments ago, maybe it applies there, that it's much harder for us to stay, as it were, where we are and engaged with the person that is before us, and to remain in that when it's not, when our thoughts are flying to other and greater things that seem to be of greater importance, you know. But what is, I think the question for us then is, what is of greater importance than the individual before us? And I think Christ tells us nothing, you know, nothing in this world that we would accomplish is of greater importance.
I think, too, what this section we just read, I mean, speaks to the idea of being recollected in thought and spirit, and then that to think that it's going to be such an easy matter of letting the horses out of the stable and then getting back there again, and it is not.
Right.
And it is a form of violence. I was so happy finally. I wrote the word violence at the top of the page,
yeah,
2 pages ago, you know. But the this is it is a kind of violence we, yeah, are experiencing when this happens.
Right. That somehow just letting them out, you know, giving them free rein, is somehow going to ease the pressure. And it might for a moment. I think he agrees with that. Like, okay, you're probably going to experience a release psychologically, but then when it all comes back, the reality comes back to you, then, you know, you might, what you'll experience is probably even worse. Mm-hmm. You know, that you've gained no greater freedom. In fact, you've made yourself even more bound to these things. So, you know, it's becoming clear why maybe the title of this is mortification, you know, a kind of dying to self and radically living for God. And, you know, we use that all the time, and it's often we use it in a very casual kind of fashion or in a cliched kind of way, you know, the taking up of one's cross daily. And, you know, as long as that satisfies us on some level, then we can live with that. You know, but I think living it on a more radical level in the way that he's discussing here requires the full self. You know, there's not one ounce of ourself that can be kept back, not one place of ourselves, you know, to be kept back from Christ. Any final thoughts or comments?
Too many. Too many thoughts.
Yeah. Too many thoughts is right. I think, you know, when we're in those situations that seem most out of control, we see what we're going through there psychologically and spiritually, because our first tendency is to try to fix, you know, the what's, you know, going on in the circumstances, or to, you know, what can I do to help the other person, or that this change the circumstances and things such as that. And the focus is very much on ourselves, and probably with the uneasiness of that reality, of the chaos of it, you know, and having to rely radically upon God, or to engage that person in the chaos. We want them to be more, you know, their angst or their depression or their anger or confusion, we want that to be far more controlled. And, you know, but to enter into that is an uneasy kind of thing for us. And so, you know, we might be surprised at times where we would do things to help people, you know, pull it together, you know, or try to help them and not have that be well received, or not have it really bear the fruit that we imagine, because not necessarily what is needed, you know. Maybe the person is going through something that is requiring them to abandon themselves more to God, and they're thrust into a chaos, and what perhaps what is needed most is a personal presence in that chaos, that they aren't isolated in the chaos, that they can remain in it without falling into despair, that they can find hope in it. And they certainly don't need us necessarily trying to fix it. In fact, they might find that deeply frustrating, because it shows them that, well, maybe you don't understand what the hell I'm experiencing, you know. On that happy note, we'll stop there tonight. It's 8:45, and powerful chapter, and so hopefully we'll be able to glean even more here in the weeks to come. So let's pray. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace. Thanks be to God.